You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
You've heard the one about the kid who asks his friend, "Why aren't you doing very well in history?" The other kid says, "Because the teacher keeps asking about things that happened before I was born." Well, if you don't know your history, I'm afraid you're setting yourself up to not be a very effective Christian. So today we're going to do a quick overview of some things you might not know about the world that Jesus was born into. It was a time of rebellion. The Jews were a conquered, occupied people. For over 500 years, they'd been the victims of empires: Babylon, Persia, Greeks, and now the Romans. But there was resistance. In fact, the region where Jesus was born, the Galilee, was a hotbed of insurgency. In 4 before the Common Era, when Jesus was about 2 years old, Jewish rebels sacked the capital of the Roman government in Galilee, a town called Sepphoris. 3 Roman legions, 18,000 troops, were said to have been sent to quell this rebellion. They burned Sepphoris and forced all of its inhabitants into slavery. Then they worked their way south, subduing all resistance as they went. When they made it to Jerusalem, they crucified 2,000 Jews suspected of being rebels. Why? As a warning. The bodies were left on the crosses to rot and be scavenged by birds and dogs. Got the message? Meanwhile, back in Galilee, 4 miles south of the smoldering ruins of Sepphoris, was a tiny village called Nazareth. There, on the fringe of the cultural and religious extermination going on, a Jewish peasant family was raising their newborn son, Yeshua. You and I call him Jesus. Considering the social, political, and cultural environment of the time, I'm going to be bold and say that if you don't know the Roman Empire, you can't possibly know Jesus. There is no way you can have a full grasp of who Jesus was if you don't know who and what he was up against. The Roman invasion and subjugation of Jewish Palestine was a generations-long struggle, of which Jesus was just one small part. And 40 years after Rome executed Jesus, the empire finally got tired of what they called the damned Jew and did their level best to exterminate them. In 70 of the Common Era, they lay siege to Jerusalem, and after a brutal 5 months, utterly destroyed the city, the temple, and massacred countless thousands. It was, after all, the Roman way. Peace through relentless, unmerciful, and overwhelming violence. Jewish historian Josephus, a military man himself, had gone over to the Roman side and had a front row seat to the Roman playbook. In order to give you a sense of the apocalyptic reality facing the Jews of Jesus' time, our words of wisdom today are an excerpt from Josephus' Chronicle of the Wars of the Jews.
Our words of wisdom are from Josephus, The Wars of the Jews, Book 6.
So the Romans, being masters of war, placed their ensigns upon the towers and made joyful acclamations for the victory they had gained, having found the end of this war much lighter than its beginning.
When they went in numbers into the lanes of the city, with their swords drawn, they slew those whom they overtook without mercy and set fire to the houses where the Jews had fled, and burnt every soul in them, and laid waste a great many of the rest. And when they came to the houses to plunder them, they found in them entire families of dead men, and the upper rooms full of dead corpses, that is, of those that died by the famine.
They made the whole city run with blood, to such a degree that the fire in many of the houses was quenched with their victims' blood. And truly, so it happened, that though the slayers left off at the evening, yet did the fire greatly prevail in the night, and all was burning.
Jerusalem, a city that had been liable to so many miseries during the siege, that had it enjoyed as much happiness from its first foundation, would certainly have been the envy of the world.
Nor did it, on any account, deserve these sore misfortunes, as by producing such a generation of men as were the occasions of this, its overthrow.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
If that all sounds pretty catastrophic to you, you're not alone. For Jews, it seemed the world was coming to an end. Burton Mack wrote, "The Jewish war destroyed more than a city, citadel, and temple. It brought to an end the history of the Second Temple. Jews of all persuasions had assumed the temple state to be God's design for Jerusalem. The end of the Second Temple meant that all the grand traditions of Israel were in question. Israel's epic was supposed to end with the Jewish occupation of the land and the establishment of a temple state at Jerusalem. Now the temple lay in ruins. The city was desolate. The inhabitants who had not fled were sold into slavery, and the land became a Roman province. For the Jews, their way of life, their whole world, had indeed come to an end. About now, you might be wondering to yourself, why is any of this important? Aren't we considering the world into which Jesus was born? Isn't this 30 or 40 years after he died? Well, here's the thing. While the historical Jesus was born some 70 years before the Jewish War, it was during the Jewish War that the canonical Jesus was born. Mark's gospel, the first canonical gospel, was written around 70, probably in response to these dark, dark days. Indeed, one of the reasons scholars place Mark around this time is on account of his vivid description of the fall of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem. Though Mark disguises what has already happened by portraying it in the form of a prophecy on the lips of Jesus. Mark's whole portrayal of Jesus was profoundly shaped by not only the Roman violence in his time, but by the collective experience of generations of Palestinian Jews. So the more you understand about Roman organization, practice, and values, the more you'll understand where the gospel writers are coming from. Well, next week is the Super Bowl, right here in Phoenix. I'm reminded of the story of the kid who was standing outside the entry gate one Super Bowl Sunday. A man came along and asked the kid why he wasn't going inside. The kid said, "Well, I don't have a ticket. I thought I could score a scalped one, but I just don't have enough money." The man said, "Son, this is your lucky day. Come with me." The kid followed the man into the stadium and found himself being escorted to a seat on the 50-yard line about 10 rows back. "Wow," the kid said, "I really appreciate you taking me to the game. How come you had an extra ticket?" The man said sadly, "Well, these tickets were for me and my wife, and my wife passed away." The kid said, "Wow, I'm sorry your wife died, but didn't any friends or family members want to come in her place? No, said the man. They're all at the funeral. Okay, so it's time for the big game. Who's going to come out on top? It's one of the most unlikely matchups in history. Who are you rooting for? The Romans or the Jews? Let's look at the teams. First, the visitors. The Romans, a total dynasty. They seem to always win, and why not? Their strategy is total domination. They call it their empire strategy. It's not like that old-school tactic the Persians used, a tributary empire. A tributary empire has a powerful center. That's where the king is, where the army is, and the outer zones are pretty loosely aligned so that as long as they pay their taxes and don't rebel, you're pretty much left to run your own affairs. The Romans, though, get right in your face. They put their offensive line out on the far boundaries of the empire, and by golly, everything inside is tightly and efficiently organized in the Roman way. Everybody on the inside better do it their way or else. How does this team do it? Day in and day out. Simple. They utilize four component parts: military power, economic power, ideological power, and political power. First up is military power. The main unit of the Roman army is called the Legion. 6,000 fighting engineers. They built all-weather ports, all-weather bridges, and all-weather roads. The Romans had paved roads connecting every corner of the empire, which afforded the legions unparalleled maneuverability. Nothing stopped the legions. They start marching at 6 a.m., travel 15 miles, make camp at 3 in the afternoon. They get a good night's sleep, and do it all over again the next day. You could set your watch to exactly how long it would take them to get to wherever they needed to be, to quell uprisings, show some force, or reinforce another legion. The Romans called it province building, and the infrastructure was vital. Second up, economic power. Since the legions were paid in money, whole cultures that had previously only existed on bartering and subsistence were monetized. Plus, all those roads, all those bridges, all those ports put in for the military were also there for commerce. So wherever the legion went, the economy boomed. This monetization also made it easier to tax people. Thirdly, political power. The Roman Empire maintained political power by Romanizing all the provinces. They made it very attractive to local leaders, dare I say, manipulated local leaders, into Romanizing everything with all kinds of fringe benefits, money, power, and influence. So they were skilled at compromising the convictions of lots of local power brokers for their own advantage. Then there's their ideological power. The imperial cult was the theological glue that held the Roman Empire together. And if we're talking glue, then we got to talk quarterbacks, don't we? The Romans' first stringer is the divine Caesar, Augustus, son of God, prince of peace, redeemer, liberator, lord of lords, and savior of the world. Not bad stats for one career. Alrighty then, let's look at the home team, the Jews. In for the Jews are the Sadducees. Fans don't know it, but these guys have been totally bought off by the opposing team. They're just as likely to throw a game for an under-the-table bonus as anything. They run the temple. They set the rules. They own the field. They pay the referees. And they write the playbook. as long as they do the bidding of the visiting team, they're rewarded handsomely and backed up with the full force and credit of the Roman Empire. That's how they got to the point of owning most of the land in the country and running the temple treasury, the national bank, and, for good measure, serve as the majority of the Sanhedrin, the national high court. Then there are the zealots. These guys are the linebackers. All they want to do is break through the line and sack something. The more blood, the better. Their solution to any problem is full frontal assault. They don't know from subtle. And as a result, keep getting picked off by the Romans. Crucifixion mainly. Then there are the Pharisees. These are the good guys. They're doing their level best to hold the middle ground for the local fans between the sleaziness of the Sadducees, the unproductive violence of the zealots, and the economic and cultural oppression of the Romans. They're like volunteer coaches for people who want to improve their game, if the game you want to play is Judaism. So some of them can be sticklers for the rules, but for the most part, they've got good intentions. Oh, and one more last-minute addition to the roster, the Essenes. We didn't even know this monastic order of Jews existed until we discovered their writings in a cave near the Dead Sea in 1947. They, in fact, wrote what we call the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they lived in the desert to stay away from the corrupt practices of the Jerusalem priests and the temple cult. Their daily worship included ritual bathing that would look to us an awful lot like baptism. We didn't really know about these players because back in 70 of the Common Era, when the Roman Legion was on its way to do what we heard about in our reading today, they stopped off at Qumran, the Essene locker room, and massacred the monks, destroyed the monastery, and burned everything to the ground. You can be sure that no one survived. So, the situation for the Jews is pretty bleak leadership-wise. They can't really even claim one quarterback. The whole team is at one another's throats. They're in such disarray, they weren't even able to really protest when the visiting team forced them to take on one of their quarterbacks, a guy named Pontius Pilate, to call the plays for home games. Crazy stuff. Let's talk about the conditions on the field at kickoff. In Jerusalem, might as well be a Roman colony. They've got a facade of Judaism going, but everything about it is compromised with Roman values and priorities. Then there's the Galilee. Beautiful, fertile area, and normally you'd say the Jews would have the home field advantage. But the sheer comprehensive dominance of the opposing team, military, culturally, politically, economically, ideologically, is weighing heavily. Every aspect of everyday life is in shreds. Using debt, taxes, and foreclosure schemes, a handful of wealthy Jewish families in cahoots with the Romans were consolidating all the small peasant farms into huge estates. Most people ended up destitute, just scraping by. Poverty, disease, and violence were the order of the day. The average life expectancy for a Jewish male in Jesus's Palestine was 29 years. It was a world full of superstition, magic, witchcraft, demons, angels, possession, and exorcism. Miracles and prophecies, divination and astrology were taken for granted everywhere. Wonder workers toured the countryside, performing miracles. It's thought that somewhere between 80 and 95% of the population was illiterate. It was unlikely that Jesus himself could read. He spent most of his life in Nazareth. Perched on a hillside, it was probably surrounded by olive orchards and cypress trees. It might have had a population of maybe only 200 people. It was definitely a backwater village and not much of a place to grow up in. It wasn't even mentioned in Hebrew scriptures, in the Talmud, or in the writings of Josephus. Yet Nazareth was only 4 miles over the hill from Sepphoris, which not only sat on one of the busiest trade routes in ancient Palestine, but during Jesus' childhood and young adulthood was being rebuilt as the capital of Galilee. So, even though we think of Jesus having had a rural background, he actually grew up an hour's walk from one of the most cosmopolitan hubs of the Mideast, bustling with commerce, Greco-Roman culture, a huge theater, and other Roman perks, like jobs for tectons or contractors like Joseph and his son Jesus. Weather at kickoff? Gloomy. Storms are forecast across the region. A lot of people simply aren't going to make it. Whole cultures are going to be swept away during the game. Favored to win? Odds are it's not the Jews. But here's some insider information. The Jews have this water boy. He's not even on the roster of official players. But he's got some great moves and is a killer storyteller. And what nobody's expecting is that in the middle of the game, this kid is going to completely rewrite the rules of play. But more on him later. Before you can truly appreciate just how remarkable this whole game is, let me remind you how important it is to know who the players are and what's going on behind the scenes before the moment of kickoff, especially with a visiting team. To put it bluntly, if you don't know Rome, you don't know Jack. John Dominic Crossan says, if you don't know his historical and cultural context, Jesus is simply a Rorschach test. You can make it all up to suit your own assumptions and prejudices. So, get to know the teams. It's only then that you can truly appreciate what Jesus was up to. Despite the long odds, despite the vast superiority of the opposition in almost every category, Jesus saw it as his task to plant a few seeds for what was essentially a whole new ball game. Even if it was in the middle of the field where two sworn rivals were fighting it out for the big championship. And if you want to know the truth, here's the sobering reality for us today. We are citizens of Rome. Our culture, with its military, economic, political, and ideological power, is the equivalent of the Roman cultural steamroller that eliminates all competition to further its own values and goals. Most of the time, to the detriment of the very people Jesus stood up for, the downtrodden, the excluded, and the disadvantaged. Our first job as followers of this upstart water boy is to not be fooled into thinking we're part of some kind of benevolent culture that has everyone's best interest at heart. No, we're citizens of an all-encompassing Roman-style culture that exists for one reason and one reason only: to maintain power. Despite chewing up and spitting out the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner among us. So open your eyes. Knowing the world into which Jesus was born not only helps us have a better grasp of what he was up against, but when we decide to take his call in our lives seriously, helps us be more than just spectators. Remember, Paul, who though a citizen of Rome himself, was eventually done in by Rome. But he encouraged us to not be deterred by the circumstances around us, to trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword, but to stay in the game. So, here's to increasing our odds by being clear-eyed and honest about what we're up against before the coin toss. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.